and to the preservation of the traditional music from his locality in North Kerry.
Broken Talkers Bellow on March 20th and 21st at the Nimoy.
Feel it in my chest.
Bellow tells the extraordinary true story of one of Ireland's foremost accordionists, Danny O'Mahony, a man who has dedicated his life to the preservation of traditional Irish music and to the mastery of his craft. Tickets and further information is available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
It shines with that. It settles that.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to the news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Massive explosions caused by a drone strike at a market in the Darfur region near Sudan's border with Chad on Thursday killed four people and wounded over two dozen civilians. That's according to a medical group. Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, blamed the strike on the army, saying the drone hit fuel reserves at the Adakong border market in West Darfur, marking the second fatal drone strike in that region in less than a month. MSF said 23 people were injured, including seven children and four women. Sudan plunged into war in April of 2023, after simmering tensions between the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF, and the army broke out into open fighting in Khartoum and spread across the country. The devastating war has killed officially more than 40,000 people, according to UN figures, but aid groups say the true number is likely many times higher. The Darfur and Kordofan regions became the epicenters of the war, with deadly drone attacks frequently reported in Kordofan. Analysts and aid workers say a surge in drone strikes in the Sudanese region of Kordofan has taken a growing toll on civilians and hampered aid operations. The war has displaced some 14 million people and has made about half the country food insecure, making it the world's worst humanitarian emergency. The Senate has advanced a sweeping bipartisan housing bill that would make U.S. housing easier to build and would include prefabricated housing. The bill would reduce regulations, regulate corporate investors, and expand how housing dollars can be used to build affordable homes and rentals. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says the bill will increase home ownership.
It will make sure that families own those homes, not giant corporations looking to jack up the rent and squeeze every nickel of profit they can.
The bill now heads back to the House, which passed a separate version earlier this year. It's unclear whether President Trump would sign it after declaring last weekend that he won't sign any new measures unless Congress passes legislation that would require voters to show proof of citizenship. The latest Labor Department numbers show that U.S. job openings rose to nearly 7 million in January. That's better than expected at a time when the American labor market has looked sluggish. The Labor Department said today that the job postings in January were up from 6.55 million in December and higher than economists had forecast. Layoffs fell slightly, and the number of Americans quitting their jobs, a sign of confidence in their prospects, slipped modestly. In the hiring boom that followed COVID-19 lockdowns, job openings peaked at a record 12.3 million in March of 2022. A pair of California legislators have reportedly returned campaign contributions from the controversial AI-powered license plate reader Flock this month. The controversial company gave the maximum amount of $11,800 each to the state Assembly Speaker Robert Rivas and Assemblymember Buffy Wicks. That's according to campaign disclosures filed this week. Representatives for both Democratic lawmakers told Politico that they would be returning the money amid concerns that Flock's data could be accessed by ICE investigators. Privacy advocates have feared that the Trump administration has tapped into license plate reader data to carry out its mass deportation agenda. Flock operates a huge network of about 90,000 cameras nationwide. It's been accused in a California class action lawsuit and by some local police departments of sharing such data with out-of-state law enforcement and federal agencies in violation of state law. The possibility of a backdoor has triggered strong backlash among residents and prompted authorities in places like Mountain View to cancel their Flock contracts. Governor Newsom said this week that there's no imminent threat of Iranian drone attacks in California, after reports emerged that federal authorities warned state officials of threats from Iranian-affiliated actors. The FBI memo sent to local law enforcement and officials in California contained unverified information for their awareness. That's according to officials who had seen the memo. According to White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, the memo was one email that was sent to local law enforcement in California about a single unverified tip. Those are the headlines. I'm Max Pringle on KPFA.
And those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we are going to talk victory in the West against one of what some may consider the Epstein class members in Los Angeles. And we get some much needed information on the next spot that Kristi Noem is supposed to be headed to, the Shield of America. All this and more starting right now. I'm so glad to be joined by Jasmine Kanick and Hussein Turk to talk about a recent victory in one of the cases against Ed Buck, stemming initially from the death of Jamel Moore, the case being Letitia Nixon, Jamel Moore's mother, versus Ed Buck. And that case happened right here, that trial right here in Los Angeles in the federal court. Jasmine Kanick is an award-winning journalist and political strategist. Hussein Turk is a brilliant movement attorney, a poet, and a yogi. You've certainly had to breathe and stretch through many twists and turns in pursuing justice for Jamel Moore, Timothy Dean, Dane Brown, and all of Ed Buck's victims. Welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Nana.
So, want to start first with you, Jasmine. You really are the spark that set it all off in terms of this pursuit of justice, as well as the engine that kept it going. There may be some folks who kind of remember, but don't really remember what we're talking about. So, wanted to first share with our listeners it's sort of the highlights of what this case, Jamel Moore, Ms. Nixon versus Ed Buck, what this was really all about. And then we'll talk about what justice and why justice was so important here. Jasmine, you might be muted.
Wait, is this better?
Yes.
I'm so sorry. Okay, first of all, then you didn't hear me say hi. Hi, Nana.
Hi.
Hi, Shane.
Hey, Jasmine.
Sorry, everyone, about that. But yeah, so back in 2017, I think Jamel Moore at the time was 26 years old, and he was flown from Houston to LA to a man's house named Ed Buck. Ed Buck was well-known political donor, Democratic donor in West Hollywood. When I say well-known, he was well-known. He'd given well over $1 million to politicians, particularly in Los Angeles County, although some outside of LA County, but mostly here in Los Angeles. And within hours of Jamel landing here, he was dead of a meth overdose in Ed Buck's apartment. Now, you know, at the time, Ed Buck had said he didn't know anything about any drugs. There was nothing to see here, sort of like the Wizard of Oz scene where it's like, you know, paid no attention to the man behind the curtain situation. And that's exactly what the sheriff's department did. And so no homicide investigation was opened at that time. And his mother, Miss Letitia Nixon, started reaching out to local journalists in the area to say, you know, hey, you know, something's not right here. She knew her son. She knew her son's situation. And she didn't believe that he just died of a meth overdose. And so a friend of mine, I think at the time he was at the LA Weekly, reached out to me and asked me to speak with her. And from there, I did. And I started, well, I first wrote about Jamel's passing. But then I, after doing that, I started getting emails and contact on through social media from other men in the area who all sort of had this really similar story about this white man in West Hollywood who would give them money. You know, he would give them drugs. You know, he would have sex with them sometimes when they were conscious, sometimes when they were not conscious, and just a whole bunch of horrible sort of things that we think we only see in television and in films, but this was happening in real life. And they had receipts. We love a good receipt. You know, we love a good email, a good Venmo, Cash App receipt. We love a good text message, right? And they had all of that, including videos. And so eventually a homicide investigation was opened. But at the time, our district attorney, Jackie Lacey, declined to file any charges in Jamel Moore's death against Ed Buck. And then in January 2019, basically a solid, 18 months later, another Black man who also happened to be gay died in the same living room of the same apartment with the same man. And his name was Timothy Dean, and he still was not arrested. And then a third man almost died, Dane Brown. May he rest in peace. He passed away in 2024. He overdosed, but managed to get out of the apartment and get help. And shortly after that, at that point, I mean, I guess, you know, the authorities were like, we got to do something, this, you know. And so they did actually arrest him. And a couple of years later, there was a federal trial and he was convicted on the 9 charges that he had, including the drug. Providing the drugs that caused the death of Jamel Moore and Timothy Dean, and sentenced to 30 years in prison. That's the shortest Reader's Digest version I could give you, because it's a long story, as you know.
And you did a great job with that short version. This is Sojourner Truth. I am your host, Nana Jumphy, and that was Jasmine Kanick, who is a political commentator, award-winning journalist, who not just wrote about what happened with Jamel Moore and all of Ed Buck's victims, but was engaged in the organizing, the keeping it going, you know, on every level. And I think that it's, you know, one of the things about this situation for me is it shows how to do the actual by any means necessary that our Baba Malcolm X talks about, right? That it wasn't just organizing and it wasn't just reporting and it wasn't just, you know, at some point the legal strategy, though it took a minute before that piece started. And it, you know, it also included pulling on the electoral piece and politicians and all of that. And I want to get into some of that because I think it's a good lesson for folks, you know, as we look at these Epstein cases. And, you know, those are the famous ones, but as we see, there's others happening all over this country that may not be as famous, to help people understand what needs to happen in terms of justice. And so first, going to you, Hussein, introducing you both as the poet and the yogi, but as well as the movement attorney. But your getting into the case initially was not about filing a case. So talk about that. You know, though you're an attorney, you had those skills, the kinds of things that you were engaged in before there was even any thought that there could be justice for these men.
So when I came to this story, before there was a case, shortly after Jamel died, and this would have been in early 2018, I was working at a legal aid project called the Los Angeles HIV Law and Policy Project, where we had funding to provide direct services to people living with HIV, as well as some funding to provide direct services to people engaged in sex work. And so that was the hook for me, because Jasmine was receiving calls, emails, notes from other victims, as she had mentioned, who were both HIV positive and engaged in sex work. And these victims wanted to come forward and share what they had experienced, what they had endured, what they had suffered at the hands of Ed Buck. They wanted to file reports with law enforcement. But as we know, or in case you don't know, now you do know, that is a dangerous thing for someone to do if they are first Black or of color, and then talking about things like drugs and sex work. They would be exposing themselves potentially to arrest. So initially I came into this to work on that piece, getting immunity for the other victims so that they could share their stories without fear of the police turning around and locking them up and not pursuing the person that they were actually complaining about. And that's how I came into this. There was no lawsuit on the horizon. This was simply about protecting people's right to file a complaint about some very egregious, violent criminal behavior.
Yes, and thank you for that. It was a lot of people, surprising number of people. You know, not surprising when we understand what's going on out here in this world, but it's certainly not what people generally had expected. And so it really meant something to have someone that was willing to go in again and again to help people, to talk, to tell their stories. And, you know, want to go back and when we come back to you to talk about what that meant for people to be able to tell their stories as part of this bigger picture. And I think both of you can respond to that. But looking, Jasmine, at you now, thinking about the organizing piece, including trying to organize electeds to give back money that Ed Buck had given them. And again, I think when I'm thinking about this Epstein files and how people are so upset, and we know all of these people's names that are in these files, and we know that some of them, if they're not politicians themselves, are people that have given to campaigns, et cetera. And I think there's a model here of disgorge and invest in care that you have to share with us when it comes to what, you know, we can be pushing politicos to do in this time of Epstein.
I mean, absolutely right. Before you started this segment, I was listening to the news, and there was a story in the news about politicians in Sacramento returning donations from Flock. And it made me think about this, how every time I hear about politicians returning money, the minute there's the whiff of a scandal or any sort of issue, they are so quick to do it, except for when it deals with Black lives. And so in the case of Ed Buck, very few people return their money. And I always say this when I talk about this, that then Congressmember Karen Bass was the first one to return her money. And let me be very clear, he was not known for giving Black politicians money. There was like a handful, and she happened to be one of them that he gave money to, and she returned it within 24 hours of finding out. But that list of politicians, many of whom are in office now, some who are running for office, for re-election and higher office, still in play, never returned their money. Lots of folks tried to, well, not tried, they did. They just ignored it and went on with their careers, unlike with what we saw with Epstein and what we're seeing with sort of other situations that come up where they're just too quick to return the money, right? And, you know, the money wasn't being asked to be returned to go into anyone's pocket in particular. It was really going into like a legal defense fund, a way to support the victims, a lot of whom were still unhoused, a lot of whom were, a lot was being asked of just in terms of like talking to law enforcement, you know, going to court, like doing certain things, right? Like to help them. And yet most of these politicians couldn't, and folks can just Google, you know, Ed Buck political donations, a bunch of stories will come up showing all the different people he gave money to and who did not return it. But for me, you know, this case was that it intersected with a lot of parts of my life, because while I am a journalist, I'm also a political strategist. I'm also a delegate in the Democratic Party. I'm also very active in politics here. And so it was very easy for me to get to people and say, hey, you need to return this money, and just sort of know the ways to sort of apply that political pressure. And so I set out to do that. Like, you know, I did, you know, it went from reporting to like advocating for, and I don't have a problem with that. Like, I am A-okay with switching gears and doing that, because I realized really early on, as many other folks did, that this situation needed community. It needed the media. It needed we had the political angle. There was just so many different areas that this case intersected with, in particular, you know, which doesn't get talked about enough, that he intentionally targeted Black men who were unhoused in LA. And you know that that is a high number of people, right? That's the, you know, every time I leave my house, that's, you know, who I see on the streets. And using your apartment, using your wealth, using the lure of drugs, using, you know, all of these things to harm folks, and then essentially for years just get away with it, just did not sit right with me, as if folks don't have enough problems, you know, in their life without being taken advantage of. And hopefully, you know, as, you know, folks learn about this case, we will all think about victims, and that white women can't be the only victims that people show up for and care about. They just can't. You have to care about all victims if you claim to be a victim's advocate. And so when you have a group of Black men, a group of Black gay men who come forward and say, look, this is what's going on, this is what this white man is doing, folks should have listened, but they didn't.
They sure didn't. They sure didn't. You're listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy, and I am speaking with Jasmine Kanick, journalist, political strategist, and Hussein Turk, movement attorney, about one of the recent cases that has gone to victory in the effort to get justice for Jamel Moore in this case, the case of Dane Brown, still down the pike. And the work to get justice is in the streets and in the courts. Let us talk a little bit about the court piece, because it definitely was, I don't want to say David and Goliath, but it definitely, because I'm like, it was, that's not, doesn't even picture the picture, but we, you know, we did have a person who had plenty of money. You don't, aren't able to give almost $1 million, or at least around $1 million in donations, because you don't have plenty money, which also could go into a legal defense. And then you had the families, right, of these people who had been killed or otherwise exploited, abused, harmed by Ed Buck, who did not have that kind of money. And so in terms of the legal piece, Hussein, you know, what would you say was really the key in being able to sustain this legal fight to this point where there actually was a victory. And congratulations to you. Congratulations. Really hard fought.
Thank you. Congratulations to all of us. This was by all means a team effort. And we were so much greater than the sum of our parts. So I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to work together. And I don't think this could have gotten as far as it did without everyone involved. I think that one of the hardest pieces, honestly, I know we have feelings about this David and Goliath comparison, but he was represented by so many lawyers and big firms, multiple firms across the country, and they had the resources to really stretch this out and to continue and continue and continue and delay and delay and delay. And so just being able to stay present and with the case over such a long period of time, over the course of about 8 years, was honestly the biggest challenge. A lot happens in 8 years, not just in a lawsuit, but in the lives of everyone involved. And so being able to stay plugged in, and to be able to respond effectively and efficiently to all of the games that defense attorneys play skillfully and sometimes not so skillfully. But the ins and outs of the litigation over the course of 8 years made this a really interesting and also very challenging case. And I think a lot of it was won in the litigation before we got to the courthouse last week. And so it was just, the duration of this 8 years and how much went into it.
It sure has been a lot. Thank you. It sure was a lot. 8 years, a lot has happened in 8 years. As we come close to the end of our time with each other, wanting to get from each of you, like what you thought was, you can give me one or two. We got about 4 minutes. What you thought was, one or two of the pivotal moments in this fight, like points when you were like, yes, that this moment was really important. Looking back at it, and we're still in it, but looking back at it, particularly with respect to Jamel's case, from the beginning when we're first hearing about Jamel, all the way, over that 8 year span, one or two really pivotal moments, Jasmine.
Okay. That's a really hard question. I guess, him being arrested and him being, convicted.
Okay. That was hard, but you got him done quickly.
I mean, for me, because all the work led up to the arrest. And then from the arrest, as a criminal defense attorney, just because you're arrested does not mean you're going to be convicted. It doesn't even mean you'll have a trial. Right. So to go and, I always tell people it's a long way from bended knee to the altar. And so to go from, and I know you're an abolitionist, Nana, but I'm not. And so, to go from the arrest and then to be in court and hear them come back with a guilty verdict, those are two moments that for me, just meant a lot, because I think for everyone involved, it also was sort of a validation. I think it was a validation for his victims. It was a validation for the families. It was a validation for the community and a lot of folks that it may take a while. Our victories are too few and far in between, but we get these victories every now and then. And for me, that was a victory. And those two moments were really, really pivotal. And, just because I'll just tack on my third would have been last week. My third would have been the jury coming back in the civil trial and awarding Ms. Nixon the $2 million signed, sealed and delivered. Prison.
I don't know about
and your money.
It's been signed. It's been signed and sealed. We'll see what right? happens with the delivery. Let's go to Hussein. One or two pivotal moments in our last couple of minutes here.
For me, the most pivotal moment that I can think of that's coming to mind right now is the death of Dane Brown. He was not killed by Buck directly, but I firmly believe that the long-term effect of what he survived, of what he endured, brought him to it did kill him. And so to me, it was a reminder that the damage, and unfortunately not in this case, the liability extends beyond this person being arrested and convicted and the actual incident, but there's a ripple effect. That really energized me at a time, many years, as I said, into the litigation when I needed to be re-energized. And it was a reminder of why we're fighting this fight, because people are still suffering the consequences of what this man did and what others like him have done and are continuing to do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks to both of you. You know, the most pivotal moment for me is the beginning when we got put together. They were defeated at that moment. Defeated
that's
then.
A good one. And let us give you your flowers then. On air. Thank you so much for everything, Nana. You've been here every step of the way, and you have played such an integral and very important part in all of these victories, even though I know you're an abolitionist. But you fought for justice for the victims in the way that felt right for your spirit, right? And you know, we thank you and we love you and we appreciate your brilliance, your legal tenacity, your foresight, as well. And so I'm so happy to be able to say that to your listeners on the air today. Just thank you so much for everything. Because folks, almost 9 years is a really long time out of someone's life to be fighting cases and fighting for justice. As those justice warrior folks out there know, it's a long, long time. We were 9 years younger when this happened, and a lot of life for all of us has happened in between. And we've managed to stay the road and stay on this case and fight for these folks and these families and these victims. And that's why the victory last week wasn't just for Miss Nixon. It was really for Dane and Cody and Timothy and Star and all of Ed Buck's victims.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much. Thank you both. We will certainly have you back on as we continue with the case with Dane Brown and other issues as they come up. That is Jasmine Canik, journalist and political strategist, Hussein Turk, movement attorney and poet. And you are listening to Sojourner Truth. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. We will have more and talk about the Shield of America. They just come up with these preposterous names on the other side of this station break.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Let that love supreme reign over the universe.
This is Saul Williams, and I'm a proud supporter of KPFK because it supports our community.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. We turn now to, you know, something that people thought was a ding dong, the witch is dead. But actually, no, Kristi Noem was removed as the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, but only to be placed in charge of something called the Shield of America. America, America, America. Not quite sure what that is, but we are about to find out. So pleased to be speaking with Marco Durazo, who teaches courses on Latino politics, social movements, immigration enforcement, and public policy. He also holds a PhD in political science from UCLA, my law school alma mater. So pleased to have you. Thank you, Marco.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored to be here, and I really appreciate the invite and the opportunity to chit-chat with you.
Absolutely, because when I saw the Shield of America, so just to let you know, I'm the ED of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration.
Yeah.
And so we deal with immigrant, you know, Black folks, immigrant rights, racial justice. And I got so many like instantaneous texts when people found out that Kristi Noem was fired. And I said, hey, I didn't see fired. Let us see what is happening. And actually, she is kind of fired, but put in charge of this thing that I have to admit I had never heard of. So I want to start there, Marco. What is the Shield of America?
Yeah, so she got demoted, and we got excited and thought she was gone, but she was simply demoted and you know, it's playing a new role here. So the Shield of the Americas, it's essentially a summit, you know, a convening led by President Trump and the United States government. They had their first gathering a couple of days ago in Southern Florida, the Trump, what I call the Trump compound down there in Mar-a-Lago. And it's essentially heads of state from various countries in Latin America and the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, Trump and, you know, our friend Kristi Noem is organizing them around two key objectives. The first is, you know, some of the work that Kristi Noem has done with immigration enforcement. And she's carried over some of the rhetoric and some of the language and some of the strategies to really speak to the first objective, where, you know, Trump says he wants to combat and undermine and eradicate drug cartels in Latin America. So that's really the first objective of this Shield of the Americas gathering and kind of collaboration project. The second, which is a little bit different, but part and parcel of the strategy, is to counter and limit Chinese influence in Latin America and the Western Hemisphere. And the interesting thing to note here is that a lot of folks, policy analysts, have been calling this approach, this hands-off, the Western Hemisphere, the Donroe Doctrine, because it implies, and it's a legacy of the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, which essentially was aimed at, you know, creating a territorial boundary around the Western Hemisphere, signaling to, at that time, European powers that was indeed the U.S.'s social, economic, and political backyard. But this doctrine is a little bit different in that it's tailored to limiting Chinese influence in the region. So Kristi Noem is part and parcel of that strategy. They're looking to eradicate drug cartels. They're looking at signaling and messaging to the Chinese that it's territorial backyard of the United States. And one thing that is a carryover from Kristi Noem's work with Homeland Security is that, you know, there's this language, and this was uttered by President Trump on several occasions at this convening in South Florida. This language of, you know, this is Trump speaking. We created a summit to undermine ISIS and terrorism. And in his mind, they were successful there. And now they've created a summit to undermine drug cartels. But that language, you know, that invoking ISIS, it really invokes the language of counterterrorism. And it suggests an expansion and, you know, expansion of the militarization of these countries' militaries and their police forces. So Kristi Noem has a new role. She's been demoted, but she's essentially redeploying the language and the strategies of immigration enforcement that we all witnessed domestically, but doing it on a larger scale through the summit in the Western Hemisphere in Latin America.
It is really insidious. You know, it's like I joke all the time about how these people come up with like these cartoon character names for things, but then they're really insidious, you know, so they're kind of like the cartoons or the comics for adults type of thing. Thinking about the continent of Africa and the way in which the conversation about counterterrorism allowed for this African command, short term AFRICOM, to just be, you know, spread and have the United States have bases all over the continent in ways that was more difficult for them to do before then. You know, most of their stuff before then was a lot more covert. It wasn't so obvious, but terrorism allowed them to do that. We already have countries like Colombia that have plenty of U.S. bases and U.S. bases throughout South America, you know, Central America, as they've gotten cozy with some of the countries there, and clearly, you know, also working with Mexico. Are these countries in South America, Central America, Mexico, like, how are they relating to this shield? Are they saying, oh, yes, because of counterterrorism, create a Latino com or something? Or are they being more resistant?
You know, that's a really great question, and that's a really apt comparison. And there's a couple of different ways to give framing to that question. I think first and foremost, you know, a lot of these folks are, you know, so at the gathering a couple of days ago, it's important to note that the president of Mexico and the president of Brazil were notably absent. So you had Ecuador, you had Chile, you had El Salvador, you had those heads of state there. And when you think about, you know, the strategy, so one, we, you know, they were clear about they want to eliminate and eradicate drug cartels. The second is that they want to undermine and deter Chinese, you know, influence in the region. A lot of these heads of states, they're partnering with the Chinese, and they're not doing it in an ideological way. They're doing it because they value Chinese investments in their countries, Chinese investments in infrastructure, energy, mining, all areas and sectors of the economy that Western powers have stepped away from. So the partnership to them with the Chinese and or the United States is non-ideological. Secondly, I think a lot of folks are there and willing to partner because, frankly, I think they're scared, right? We're not too recently removed from the capture and the kidnapping of the president of Venezuela, President Maduro. And I think a lot of these smaller countries, these heads of states are, they don't play ball. They cross the Trump, you know, policy agenda. You know, they can be playing a dangerous game with a regime and a government that's more than willing to step in and remove them forcibly and incarcerate them in the United States on charges that may or may not be valid. So I think the first response there is a lot of them are engaging in a non-ideological way. Secondly, I think some of them have some concern about the way that Trump, you know, is kind of demarcating these boundaries around the Western Hemisphere. And I think thirdly, somewhat related to the example and the historical legacy of, you know, colonialism and imperialism, since we're harking back to the Monroe Doctrine, is that, you know, Kristi Noem was quoted there as saying that, you know, we're defending our own security and economic prosperity. And, you know, this is a powerful example of how we can work together to protect one another's sovereignty. You know, that language and those promises and those positions coming from the U.S. have a, you know, there's a skeptical legacy in Latin America when that language is deployed by the U.S., right? We only have to point back to military coup in Guatemala in 1954, to them forcibly removing Manuel Noriega in Panama in 1989, all the way up to, I think, earlier this year with Maduro in Venezuela. So, you know, they want to convene this body. I think folks are there. A lot of these heads of states are there out of, you know, national convenience and interest. But from my gathering, it's not ideological. There's an element of fear. And there is this historical legacy of the U.S. demarcating these boundaries, enforcing them, and removing heads of state if need be. So I think that Trump always has that card in his back pocket. And I think some of these heads of state believe that he may be willing to use it if necessary. So there are comparisons, and there are a lot of parallels between those two examples.
Yeah, they're not dumb. And I think we should call it the Dumro doctor instead of the Donro doctor. Give him no credit at all. This is Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. We're speaking to a Dr. Marco Durazo, professor who teaches courses on Latino politics, social movements, immigration enforcement, and public policy. We're talking about the Shield of the Americas and why people may be seeming to bend the knee. Continuing with that, I think when you start blowing up people in the middle of the Caribbean Sea and with that, with impunity and seizing people's ships, etc., it gives people a sense and grab people's presidents and take them away with their families. It gives people a sense that maybe they ought to play ball with these gangsters. We just know how that always turns out. And so for those countries like Brazil, like Mexico, which it seems that this administration or this regime, as I prefer to call it, doesn't really know how to deal with them. Like on the one hand, he wants to act like he and Lula can be cool. On the other hand, Lula's not cool with him. And you sort of have the same situation in Mexico. What are they saying? What signs, if any, are they giving about why they are not joining the Shield of the Americas?
Yeah, great question. You know what? I think, like, you know, let's talk about Mexico a little bit, where, you know, Trump at this gathering, essentially, and he has said this in other contexts, but he repeated it at this inaugural gathering, is that Mexico is the epicenter of drug cartel activity. And, you know, if I were the head of state of Mexico and I was kind of getting the vibes from Trump that he may violate sovereignty and may deploy forces into my country, you know, I probably wouldn't play ball and be part of the summit either. But the language and the framing that Trump continues to deploy along with Kristi Noem, it's problematic on many levels and it's misguided. And this is where I think you see the connection between law enforcement, police activity, war on drugs, as we know it in a domestic sense, and the reapplication of this kind of paradigm and the strategy across the Western Hemisphere. So for Trump to say that Mexico, quote unquote, is the epicenter of drug cartel activity, it simplifies a very complex transnational enterprise and process that extends above and beyond Mexico's borders and boundaries. We all know that drug cartels operate internationally and throughout Latin America. So to simply say that as the epicenter, it's a bit simplistic. I think also an inconvenient truth that I think Trump and his administration don't want to signify or don't want to address is that the United States remains the largest, most profitable drug market in the United States. So for him to simply say, you know, we're going to recast or imply, I should say, we're going to recast the strategy on the war on drugs, we're going to criminalize it, we're going to militarize these police forces across Latin America, that didn't work domestically, and it's not going to work in the Western Hemisphere, and it's not going to work in Latin America. Those strategies have been tried, and they failed. So there is an element of fear. There is a sense that territorial sovereignty will be violated. But there's also this sense that they don't know any better, and they deploy these strategies, they deploy this language because they're going to be effective. And I think recent history is clear that they won't work. And they're simplifying very complex problems and demonizing the wrong people in order to, you know, generate political capital for future elections.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just archaic. But, you know, so is bombing people. And particularly folks in the Middle East, you know, there's a lot of archaic stuff that they're bringing back and trying to make seem like it's brand new. Mm-hmm. Looking at the China piece, and I think it's important because even amongst the left, not the lefty left, but let's say the center left, there is a willingness to see China as the villain and to be concerned about China being in other countries. Of course, when we look at countries and on the continent, again, in the Caribbean, in the Americas, quote unquote, including this country, by the way, there is a lot of interaction, a lot of investment by China, maybe in this not in this country in the same way as in other countries, but it's because the Chinese are willing to do that, right? And so talk a little bit more about this China piece, because it's hard sometimes for me, even as I'm explaining to people, that I'm not saying that it's fabulous. I mean, as a Pan-Africanist, as a revolutionary, I want Africa to do with Africa and do for Africa and build our own bridges and build our own airports. And also, I understand that what China is doing is not the same as what Europe did, you know, 500-600 years ago. Like, I know that that's not the same thing. We're not all walking around in Ghana speaking various languages from China, right? And so talk a little bit about that. We are speaking English. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, what's interesting is that a couple of dynamics, and that China has, over the last two decades, over the last 20 years, I guess you could say quietly, but with a steady hand, have really become, has become a major trading partner for many of Latin American countries. There was a documentary, you know, a segment on 60 Minutes not long ago, maybe in January, and I watched it, and it shocked me when they talked about China's penetration to consumer markets in Mexico and Latin America. And they had stated that 20% of new car sales in Mexico are Chinese electric vehicles. So one out of every five vehicles, new vehicles sold in Mexico, is a Chinese model, and it's an electric vehicle. So they have spent decades penetrating these different. And I would imagine that number is either similar or higher in other countries. But according to 60 Minutes, they said one out of five of every vehicle, every new vehicle sold in Mexico, is a Chinese electric vehicle. So they've been penetrating these markets, providing consumer goods. They're locked out of the U.S. market, so they've been, you know, selling their merchandise throughout Latin America. And I think one problem that the Trump administration is going to have, and they're seeing it in the Middle East, and they're seeing it in Africa, and they're seeing it definitely in the Western Hemisphere, is for them to simply say, you know, this is the Donroe Doctrine, and this is the United States' backyard. You know, the Chinese are like, you know, wait a minute, we have multi-billion dollars investment in those regions. It's not going to be as easy to say it's off limits now. They've been there. They've been there for decades. They've invested billions of dollars. So that is something that the Trump administration is going to have to figure out how to respond to, right? You can't just cut the cord and say it ends here because they're deeply invested. And, you know, and some of the other investments that China has committed to in Latin America, as I alluded to earlier, investments in infrastructure, mining, energy projects, because Western powers have pulled out or decreased investments in those industries that these countries rely on and need. So Trump he needs to develop a strategy, and the people around him need to tell him better. It's that it's not as simple as saying it's off limits and this is our backyard. And because I had said that these countries are engaging in non-ideological terms, is Trump and the United States going to step forward and provide those investments in mining and industry and consumer goods that the Chinese have stepped forward to provide? That's a question that he's going to have to answer in a material way to these leaders if he would like to keep this summit, Shield of the Americas, Summit of the Americas together. So it's convoluted. It's complicated. The Chinese have deep investments in that region. And, you know, and I get the parallels, and I know a lot of folks are also wary of the demonization of the Chinese and, you know, as a foreign power. And I think those concerns, you know, are conversations that should be had. But a lot of these Latin American leaders are engaging in a non-ideological way. But what is happening as the United States and as Trump draw these boundaries, it really harkens back to these times of this great power competition, right? Where we're drawing boundaries, we're undermining each other's foreign investments, and it can really lead to an escalation of competition and rivalry between these two countries like we haven't seen in the past. So those are dangers from a kind of a geopolitical standpoint, because no country is going to step back, especially a country like China, and allow billions and billions of dollars of their investments to go away because Trump decided that the Western Hemisphere was his backyard, right? So that could lead to geopolitical fallout in the future, and it's something to be wary of. So, and if we're going to draw that boundary, again, are the United States Western influences willing to step in and fulfill those funding needs that these countries need to operate. So those are huge questions aren't being answered. And it makes us think a little bit more about how this geopolitical realignment is going to match up between China and the United States in the foreseeable future.
Absolutely. And then you think about BRICS, which the C in there is about China, the B in there is about Brazil, right? And there's so many other countries that have jumped in. That is another piece in terms of, you know, that economic connection. And then, you know, I want to think about this also in the context of how this regime in the United States seems to turn its back on, pull away from, you know, disregard institutions that are global, that are international, that already exist, and try to set up its own. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, OK, we're not going to look at the United Nations. Instead, we're going to have our own little peace board, Board of Peace. And then here there's the Shields of America. And it's like, OK, you do have an organization of American states. You do have, you know, these other that has all these entities that are dealing and trying to work through a lot of the conflicts, issues, challenges that are facing the Americas, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But you're building something else. Right. A little bit. I mean, we're winding down in our time. We got a couple of minutes, but speak a little bit about that, please, Professor Durazzo.
Yeah, you know, and that's another part and parcel of Trump's approach, lack of strategy, and lack of patience or foresight for collective organizational bodies. You know, so we started off by, you know, speaking of to the objectives of this Shield of the Americas. And, you know, one of them is the drug cartels. The other one's Chinese influence. The United Nations and other collective bodies are already well aware of drugs and how they undermine communities and societies. And this is where Trump going, you know, I think the administration, you know, developing these infrastructures from scratch and being very selective on who's invited and who's allowed to sit at the table and redeploying, redeploying these strategies like the war on drugs that just don't work, because you can militarize your police forces. You can, you know, drop a heavy hammer. But like the war on drugs in the United States and in Latin America, unless you're addressing the social and economic needs of these countries, you're not going to have success. Unless you're doing it in a very collaborative kind of global way, you're not going to have long-term success. So, you know, those are part of the Trump administration's impulses, and it really speaks to you know, the motto, right? If you want to go quickly, go alone, right? But if you want to go long-term, go together. And I think it's easy to assemble these folks. It's easy to bring these people out to Mar-a-Lago. It's not likely that they're going to have long-term success because they continue to go it alone and undermine global collective bodies that are already investing and interested in this kind of work and these policy issues.
Yeah, person of my own heart, quoting that African proverb. Thank you so very much, Professor Durazzo. Really appreciate you coming on. We certainly look forward to speaking more with you as we follow this and other things happening in the Americas.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
That's our show, folks. I'd like to thank all of our guests. I'd love to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our hardworking board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, my brilliant and so, so helpful assistant producer, Gary Scott. And I want to thank wonderful, fabulous you for listening and for joining us today. Let's get together at the same time and the same place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
Please don't do this to me. Yes! Come on, come on, come on, come on! Yes, yes, yes! Come on! Oh! God, son of a piece of... I give up.
If that old junker in your driveway is a lost cause, you can always donate it to KPFK through our auto donation program. It's as simple as calling 877-KPFK-AUTO and asking the operator to assist you in arranging for a pickup.
We'll tow it away and we'll mail you all the necessary paperwork for you to write it off of your taxes. Call us now at 877-KPFK-AUTO or donate online at kpfk.org by clicking Pledge Support.
Tune in for some fresh raps and classic cuts right here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and beyond on some breakbeats and rhymes.
Breakbeats and rhymes. Big things, baby, yo.
Breakbeats and rhymes.
Hey, yo, yo, y'all can't stand right here. In his right hand was your man's worst nightmare. Loud enough to burst his right eardrum close range. The game is not only dangerous, but it's most strange.
Heard every Friday night from 10 to midnight.
Break beats and rhymes hosted by Rebels to the Grain.
Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight.
Break beats and rhymes.
Break beats and rhymes.
KPFK, break beats and rhymes. It's good for your mind.
You know we stay hungry for them break beats and rhymes. It's a safe favorite.